Hello, I'm Peter Terzakian. The story you're about to hear is from EnergyFile, a project I'm really excited to share with you. Part museum, part library, and part business school. It's where energy stories from the past open our minds to the present and help us plan for the future. Enjoy.
The Investor Visit by Peter Terzakian.
Not long now. It's just over this hill.
Even against the car's noisy engine and grinding wheels, the stock promoter's excitement was apparent.
I hope your hunch is right, Fred.
Graham gripped the shuddering steering wheel of his late-model Chalmers Detroit.
I'm already sold on the future of oil, but out here, in this wilderness?
Oh, I think you'll be impressed with the operation, Graham.
It was a glorious summer day in the Canadian Rocky Mountains. Graham had taken off the car's top, unrolled the windows, and removed its front windscreen. He'd figured they may as well enjoy the ride before they got down to business. Sitting beside their respective husbands, Amy and Esther clung to their hats lest they blew away. They'd expected a relaxing day trip in Waterton Lakes National Park, not this dusty drive to a drilling rig. Regardless, they were determined to make the most of it. Suddenly, Fred lurched forward from the back seat.
There's the rig now.
Graham kept his eyes on the last turn in the road, but Amy and Esther looked to where Fred was pointing.
Well, this certainly isn't beautiful Waterton Park, is it, Graham?
As they crested the hill, Graham surveyed the discouraging view himself. In the valley below, a tilted smokestack belched black clouds and barrels were strewn around the site. Fred giggled as Graham maneuvered his car to the rig, cranked the safety brake, and cut the engine with a flourish. He'd used the gains of his last two oil investments to buy it, and was still smug about the purchase. Up ahead, a man waved at them.
That's the photographer,
Fred explained, hopping out of the car.
He's photographing the property to show other investors how their money's working for them. Let's give him a handsome shot.
With that, Fred crossed his arms and struck a pose. The others remained where they were, faces grim, trying to ignore the dull pounding of the drilling rig's steam engine. After tensing their muscles for what seemed an eternity, the group was relieved when the photographer sprung from behind his black velvet camera hood.
Thank you, all done.
Thus, a fleeting moment in the summer of 1915 was captured for posterity. I found the photograph of these four day trippers at an antique fair in the early 2000s. The print was in rough shape. Mounted on black cardboard that had obviously had a decades-long love affair with dust, it was poorly exposed and cracked around the edges. Nonetheless, nostalgia drew me to that image of the wooden derrick, perched awkwardly in a southern Alberta valley. Recognizing a classic energy vignette, I bought it immediately. Years later, I made a high-res scan of the print and spent hours restoring it. As I zoomed in to every nook and cranny, I reflected on the environmentally challenging scene. The barrels littering the site, the coal-black smoke drifting down the valley. In contrast, the well-appointed visitors look out of place. Dressed more for a picnic in a Henry James novel than a visit to this drilling rig in the middle of nowhere. Who were these people, and what circumstances brought them there that summer day?
Graham, you made your fortune in Alberta coal, but I'm telling you, the future's oil. Every wheel in the world is going to turn with the stuff. Just wait. You'll have a smile from here to Texas once this here well starts gushing.
Years of investing had made Graham shrewd. Recognizing the shift of folksy patter, he walked a few paces before responding to Fred's rehearsed hyperbole.
I already told you. You're preaching to the choir.
As if to underline his point, Graham kicked a rock.
I know more folks are getting rid of horses and buying automobiles, meaning more lubricants, more oil for fuel. Why the devil you think I bought shares in this company you're promoting?
You got it, Graham.
Spying an opportunity, Fred pounced.
I sure wouldn't want to be a chump raising horses now. Or how about making horseshoes?
As they approached the great steam engine, Fred continued his sales pitch.
Besides oil and autos, the future is gas pumping devices, stations to cater to travelers. You might be interested in other deals I've got cooking.
Between Fred's promotional babble and his own first impressions of the site, Graham started to feel queasy about his investment. He was relieved to see Alan, the CEO, striding toward them. Surely this man would ease his concerns. You couldn't miss Alan. His crisp linen suit, silk cravat, black shoes with beige spats, and straw boater made him look like the gent who guessed your weight at the carnival. Graham recognized the flamboyant attire as a common status symbol for nouveau riche oilmen. A little flashy for the investor's taste, but he didn't mind. He knew guys like Alan were tough enough to use gasoline for aftershave. Graham looked for passion, not fashion, in a CEO.
Quite the operation you've got here.
Graham greeted Alan, noting the executive's firm handshake.
Before you know it, this well here will be gushing.
Alan sounded a lot like his pitch man, Graham noted skeptically. The engine's banging metal, creaking wood and puffing steam, distracted the threesome for a moment. But they snapped out of their reverie when the rig hand stepped from behind the shed. In grease-stained flannels and a moth-eaten hat, he was the only person who looked like he belonged in the site. Alan waved him over.
Fellas, this here's Jake. He's the one who really runs the operation.
As Jake reached out to shake hands, a grinding squeal sounded from the engine. Letting loose a stream of Anglo-Saxon, he swiftly turned and yanked some levers, oblivious to the grease splattering his shirt. For Graham, the sight of Jake wrestling the rig works was an entertaining contrast to Ellen's great Gatsby act. The term tough guy didn't do Jake justice. Graham could easily imagine this foul-mouthed driller smoking a cigarette rolled out of coal. Fred, Graham, and Alan started up the hill, away from the noise.
We're planning to drill at least 1,000 feet, Graham. 13 years ago, wells around here were flowing 300 barrels a day from a zone starting at 1,020. At the rate we're pounding out the rocks, we should be at target in about a month.
Fred, spotting another chance to sell, jumped in.
Notice the rig is burning coal in the steam engine? It's cheap and plentiful. We pick it up from nearby mines. It might even be coming from one of yours, Graham.
He grinned and winked. Put off by the over-familiarity, the visiting investor glared at both men.
Can't say I'm thrilled. You're using my fuel to explore for a competitor. But I'll adapt and make money on both ventures.
Fred and Alan nodded in support. They knew why Graham didn't find this funny. Diesel engines were starting to take over from coal-fired steam engines, especially on ships and trains. Graham's coal mines were vulnerable.
Listen, I'm not scared of change. I'm not scared of investment risk. I love both. Put them together, you can make a lot of money. But what kind of two-bit operation are you running here?
Graham shrugged.
Why use this old cable tool rig that bashes the rock with a spike? If you had a more modern setup, you could drill two holes with my money, instead of just one.
Alan's cheeks flushed under the criticism.
This site is...
Landed in your lap. You got the grandfather drilling rights, and you're kidding yourselves if you think those will last forever. Hell, you could lose them tomorrow if you keep making this mess.
Graham stabbed a finger toward the carelessly strewn barrels.
I don't want to lose my money because of more government regulations.
Graham's voice notched up, along with his irritation.
Besides, word is, there are better prospects north in Turner Valley.
He paused, hoping for a response, but when none came, carried on.
I don't see any opportunity to scale here. This is a national park.
The CEO's cheeks grew redder. Fred cut in before Alan spoke his mind, Jake style.
You're right, Graham. Rotary drilling is the next big thing, but this rig was ready to go. It's paid for, and we'll get the job done. Once we're producing oil, we'll have cash. We bring in fancy new tools, costs go down, production goes up, and we'll clean this place up. Right, Alan?
He patted Alan on the back.
We'll get a fellow on the Turner Valley play. Winner takes all, Graham. You can't say fairer than that.
The investor could see he wasn't getting through. Fred and Ellen forced thin smiles as he gestured dismissively at the rig.
Here's the rub. I get annoyed when I see my money funding high-cost, antiquated operations that'll go the way of the candle. Whether it's drilling for oil, or mining for coal, or building horse carts, or windmills.
He hauled back and kicked at another rock.
Doesn't matter if you're in yesterday's tired business or have your finger on the doohickey everyone'll be using tomorrow. You gotta lead change, drive down costs. If you don't, you'll lose a lot of money. A lot of my money.
Graham's words echoed through the valley.
We're on it. You have my word, sir.
Brushing dust from his spats, Alan offered.
Why don't I give you a proper tour?
As they walked back down, Alan pointed out the rig mast and began outlining their grand plans for the operation. Graham had to admire their optimism, but his lecture had obviously fallen on deaf ears. It was fun to make believe Graham, Fred, Amy, and Esther, not to mention Dapper Alan and Salty Tongue Jake. The real identities of the people in the photo are anyone's guess, but given what I know about oil and gas finance, I'm probably not far off on their roles. Besides, my story isn't complete fiction. In the late 19th century, entrepreneur John Lynham saw oil seeping from the ground by Cameron Creek, which cuts through the spectacular southern Alberta Valley close to where the photo was taken. Raising money and mobilizing equipment, Lynham's Rocky Mountain Development Company drilled its first well in 1902. At 1,020 feet, its rig struck oil and produced a very respectable 300 barrels a day at first. The promise of riches from the original well and those that followed evaporated quickly. Production from the company's last well, drilled in 1905, withered. Other companies had similar lack of luck in the area. Oil City, the resource town that had started to develop around the boom, was abandoned. However, dreams of the region's big oil gushers didn't fade easily. A decade later, the original Discovery Oil Company chased those dreams with hyperbole. Chalking up earlier failures to Rocky Mountain Development Company's lack of precaution and funds, original Discovery claimed in its prospectus that it was in a position to offer to the shrewd and careful speculator one great big opportunity. The recently opened Alberta Stock Exchange was a boon for high-risk companies and stock promoters like Fred. In 1914, Original Discovery raised a then-staggering $1 million through its public share offering. My reading of the prospectus suggests it was that same $1 million that financed the drilling operation in my photo. You won't be surprised to hear that Fred and Ellen's smooth words proved unfounded. For all the reasons Graham observed, the Original Discovery Oil Company was a money-losing proposition. Waterton never delivered meaningful quantities of oil. The $1 million frittered away to nothing, and the well was abandoned in 1920. Modern rotary rigs and Turner Valley to the north were where the real money was made. After immersing myself in the past, I pulled out photos from my own field trips. Fred and Ellen's antique operation paled beside my modern images of giant metal rigs adorned with hefty hydraulic machinery. As I contemplated both how much and how little the industry has changed, I imagined the same scenario playing out a century later.
Nice car.
Fred patted the dashboard of Graham's new electric vehicle.
Ride's so silky smooth and quiet.
Thanks. These babies are the future of transportation, you know.
Amy leaned forward from the back seat.
Our daughters love riding in it.
I bet they do. I feel like a kid myself.
Well, theirs is the generation that will champion this technology. By the time they're our age, every wheel in the world could be turning thanks to electricity.
Fred nodded slowly, only half listening.
Oh, here's the exit. Should take us to the north side of the oil field. The drill site's just off the highway.
Graham guided his vehicle onto the exit ramp.
Let me level with you, Fred. Amy and I are reluctant to invest any more in oil and gas.
Electrification and fuel economy, that's the future.
Fred scratched a bony knob behind his ear, considering her words.
I know, but I promise you'll be impressed with this operation. The equipment may be a bit long in the tooth, but next year we'll have high productivity, low-cost pad drilling in place, giving us incredible economies of scale. We'll be cost competitive with any energy system, old or new. That is a guarantee.
I'm glad to hear it, Fred, because I get annoyed when people use our money to fund high-cost antiquated operations on the tail end of change.
And trust me, if Graham makes a bad investment, he hears about it from me.
Never marry your business partner.
Well, just wait till you're on the floor of the rig looking up at that mast. You'll see.
Growing impatient with Fred's sales pitch, Amy rolled her eyes and continued Graham's lesson.
Doesn't matter whether it's drilling oil or installing wind turbines or solar panels. You need to lead change and mind your costs, or you're going to lose a lot of money.
At those words, I snapped out of my daydream. Reflecting on the fictitious financier's comments, past and present, I nodded instinctively. The Graham and Amy types I've met in business echo my own experiences as an investor. Overzealous management that relies on waning technology is always a bad bet.
Thanks for listening. For more on this story, visit energyfile.org/investorvisit. That's energyphile.org/investorvisit. The Investor Visit was written by me and edited by Laurie Burwash, with audio production by Bo Sheminsky at Ear Candy and voices by Jonathan Love, Jim Talheimer, Anna Kummer, and Scott Roberts.